this particular company that I'm going to mention, they haven't done really well, but this was a very, very good lesson for my kids. They used to play Roblox a lot, especially during COVID. And when Roblox was going public, that was a perfect time for us to like teach our kids about investing. So we did buy some Roblox shares and, you know, they're not doing that well, but that's okay. To me, it was a great learning lesson. So, you know, we were so excited about this IPO and we were explaining to them like, why is Roblox, you know, going public? Oh, well, they need this money from the rest of us who believe in Roblox, and they're going to invest this money and try to build even a better company. And then we would watch the news, or I would like, if we're having dinner or like I'm driving them somewhere, I would be like, oh, Roblox was in the news and this is what they said. Do you think the price is going to go up or it's going to go down? So, you know, it was just involving them to understand that they have actually invested money into a business.
Welcome to the Healthy Love and Money podcast. If you find money to be the number one, two, or even third largest source of stress in your relationship, then you're in the right place. Going beyond how to budget, invest, and do your taxes, we're going to explore financial intimacy. Discover how to talk with your partner about your shared financial life. Let's take the awkward and painful out of money conversations. Join me and hit follow to listen to weekly inspiring, healing, and motivating interviews with financial therapists, couples therapists, and financial planners, and so many more. Let's go on the journey of financial intimacy together. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Healthy Love and Money podcast. Today, it's my distinct honor to welcome Maya Korbik to the show. Now, Maya has a deep passion for helping parents talk to their kids about investing, and she's got an incredible backstory that's led her to this mission of helping families talk about money. Now, what you'll come to find out through this interview is she also is a well-being nut. Is it fair to say, Maya?
Absolutely.
By professional training, CPA, but by day, she is all in on well-being. She even made sure before we started the show to say, this is not coffee, this is my health drink. And so I'm going to let her describe all the ingredients there. But Maya, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Ed. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, it was such a blast to meet you recently at the FinCon conference in New Orleans, you know, a group of many money people trying to help get out positive messages about money. And you're certainly on the leading front there with your Instagram page and the new book that you have come out. So can we just lead with that? Can you tell people about your Instagram page and your new book that you've launched?
Sure. Yeah. So, but before I actually had this Instagram page and before the book happened, I actually was teaching kids about money. I used to go to schools and do workshops. And I also used to teach parents by going into schools and doing workshops. And then COVID happened. So that halted my live workshops. And then I started expanding more online. And at first it was really hard, but then being online enabled me to reach wider audience, which was fantastic. And by reaching the wider audience, that's kind of how my Instagram account, teach.kids.money, expanded. And what actually I learned through that account was that a lot of people don't know much about investing. It intimidates them. And because it intimidates them, they will never be able to teach their own children because they're intimidated by it. So that kind of prompted me to write the book.
Yes. Yeah. So that intimidation about investing is something that continually shows up for so many people. And as listeners are listening, just check in with yourself. How intimidated do you feel by investing? Just do a scale real quick as you're listening, 1 to 10, 10 being really intimidated, 1 not so much. And by the end of the show, my hope is that your number would be lower after what you hear Maya share. So Maya, what your investing approach and helping parents talk about investing with their kids, can you lay it out for us?
Sure, yes. So, you know, it kind of, we slightly talked about this before the show began, but I feel that a lot of times, many people think investing is gambling, or if you're investing in a company, many people don't even know what they're investing in. So my advice is to never invest into something you don't understand. But furthermore, when it comes to investing, there are really three different types of investors. And there are people that are day traders. And day traders are those typical investors that you see sitting in front of their computer the whole day. They're watching these crazy graphs and they're like making these trades and it's high stress and it's crazy. But that's just one group of people. And typically, these day traders, they don't hold their stocks for longer than a day. They're also short-term investors. And, you know, they hold their stocks for a bit longer. And it's not as, they're not as, you know, glued to their computers as much as day traders. But majority of the people who are interested in investing or who think that they should be investing because they want to reach certain goals are long-term investors. We are investing for some long-term goals, whether it's our pension, whether it's for our children's college, maybe we're investing to buy a home one day or whatever it is. So when it comes to long-term investing, what I discovered much later on in life, and I wish this is something I discovered as a teenager, because even as a teenager, I was interested in investing, but I also found it very intimidating. There's an easy, and I call it lazy way of investing, and it's investing in ETFs and index funds. And I know right away some people's backs are going to go against the wall and they'll be like, okay, what are in the ETFs and index funds? That sounds really scary. So if you really think of an index, I'm just going to break it down real quick. Index is something that tells us how a certain group of stocks are doing. So for the purposes of this episode, I'm going to use index called S&P 500. What that index is, it just basically has all the 500 largest and the best performing US companies. So companies like Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and so on. So this index, if it goes up, it kind of tells you that all these companies are generally doing well. It can also be indication that our economy is doing well. If it goes down, it's obviously these companies are not doing that well. When you're investing in an index fund, and there are many different index funds, but there are some index funds, for example, that follow S&P 500 very closely. Essentially, when you invest into that fund, you're investing in all 500 largest and the best US companies at the same time. So instead of picking and choosing, you know, oh, I only have so much money, I can invest in Microsoft, but I can't invest in Google. And I really want to invest in Facebook, but I can't invest in Amazon. You're actually investing in all of them at the same time. And the beautiful thing is, it's kind of like a self-cleansing index, because if one of these companies, doesn't do well on the S&P 500, it's taken off the index and it's replaced by another company. And automatically your investment reflects that. So you don't have to worry about picking and choosing these companies. And another beautiful thing is that index funds and ETFs are very low cost. So, if you want to manage this by yourself, and let's say you don't want to pay high fees to your advisor, it costs you a lot less than it would to, you know, hire an advisor. And another thing is diversification. When you invest into index funds and ETFs, you're investing in a large variety of different companies. And so there are many, many benefits to this. I mean, I could talk about this all day, but I'm sure we want to talk about other things. So definitely look up ETFs and index funds.
Well, I think that's a really great introduction, right? And I appreciate you acknowledging that even just hearing the word index funds and ETFs can feel very overwhelming and your back can kind of go against your chair, so to speak. And that fear of investing is very real for a lot of people. And I think the thing that I was listening as I was hearing you talk is just hearing different people's voices talk about the same topic can make it more approachable for people. And so I just love hearing you describe it in your own language, and especially the self-cleansing, like drawing on some of your wellness language in the ETFs. And I've never quite heard it said that way, but I do like that. And I think, there is a little bit of a learning curve in learning some of the language, but you don't have to go get an MBA or become a financial planner or a CPA to do this type of investing. With a little bit of reading and research and a few podcasts, you can really be off to investing pretty quickly. In your journey of teaching adults about investing, how does that then translate into the way that they're able to talk to their kids about investing? Because I imagine parents don't talk to their kids about investing, probably because they don't know about investing. So Can you talk about that journey and what you see happening?
Sure. Yeah. So absolutely. You know, it's exactly what you said. If the parents do not learn or do not feel comfortable about investing, they will not teach their own children. And that's the message that I'm trying to get out there, because I want parents to realize that if they don't teach their children about investing, no one else is going to teach them. This is not something that they will learn in school. Even though the schools have become really good lately in introducing certain financial literacy concepts, but they don't teach investing. The only way your child will learn about investing, if they don't learn from you, would be if they go into that profession, or maybe they just take some time to learn on their own. But the time is of essence, because, you know, there's something called compound interest. Einstein called it the eighth wonder of the world. So the sooner our kids start investing, the better off they will be. And, you know, on my Instagram, I quite frequently post these kind of like graphs that actually show what happens if you start investing as a child versus a teenager versus an adult. And, you know, that those posts are very, very popular, but they're just not there, you know, to like for people to look at and marvel at the difference. It's more like to inspire people to take action. So I also know that, you know, especially at the beginning, it may be very, very intimidating to get started. So what I tell parents, there are a couple of things that I tell parents. The first one is obviously educate yourself. The second one is, maybe start investing with like $10 or $20. Nowadays, there's so many different platforms out there. You don't need a lot of money to start investing. Start with investing with like $10 or $20, something that you feel you can lose, you know, if things go bad. Hopefully they won't, because you're educating yourself. And then, you know, you keep investing every month the same amount, and you get more familiar with that platform. And, you know, you build that confidence. And when you build that confidence, then chances are that, you know, all of a sudden you might want to invest a little bit more money, and then you're going to learn even more. And then you may want to move that money into like a different, I don't know, fund or something like that. But the key is to get started. Sometimes, you know, if we have too much information, you know, we can be paralyzed. It's that whole analysis paralysis thing, right? So, So it's just getting started. And, you know, even if you don't want to do anything, any one of these things, one thing that I recommend to parents is, let's say for your child's birthday or special occasion, you know, in addition to the main gift, if you can afford, buy them a share of a stock of a company that they know and understand. And I'm using this as an example. It doesn't mean that you should be investing in this, but let's say Apple. A lot of teenagers or a lot of kids have iPads or cell phones. So instead of just being consumers, you know, using that those electronics, they can be owners. They can own some shares of Apple. So that's another way to get started.
Yeah, I think the thing I hear is curiosity is such a valuable resource here, is getting curious about what does it mean to be an investor? How do I do it? But also balancing that curiosity with not researching forever. Sometimes you got to take a little bit of action, let that provide some feedback, and then learn a little bit more, and then get some feedback, and then learn a little bit more. But we're not saying put all of your life savings into an investment. That's not the starting place. We're saying start with small amounts and slowly get more proficient. I'm like, you didn't start out as a CPA investing whiz that loves talking about this for hours and hours on end. Where did you grow up? Tell us about your backstory.
Yeah, so I actually grew up in Bosnia, which used to be part of Yugoslavia. There was a war there, and my parents immigrated to Canada with two suitcases and $50. We lost everything in the war. And when we immigrated, we had to live in government shelters, government housing. I had two part-time jobs when I was in high school, just to, you know, pay for my school supplies and bus tickets and whatnot. So I couldn't really rely on my parents to give me a better life. Like, I realized it was all on me. And so, you know, that prompted me to push really hard, be a really good student. I did the traditional route. Like, I, you know, went to school, got good grades, got into one of the best universities, got good grades, I got a good job. And so, and, you know, that was my way of, I guess, getting out of the situation that I was in. And I also started really watching my money and tried to be really good with it. My husband and I, when we got married, we had $60,000 in debt. And within 8 years, we ended up paying that off, including our mortgage at the time. So we were debt free. And when I was 32, I realized that I didn't have to work anymore. So that's when I quit my job and I wanted to do something different, something a little bit more fulfilling, which is essentially what I ended up, what I'm doing right now, teaching kids about money.
So you go from the daughter of immigrant children fleeing a war-torn country. Your parents arrive here, two suitcases and $50. And you follow a pretty traditional immigrant success story of focus really hard on studies. Were your parents very focused on pressuring you to be good in school, or was that more internally motivated?
It was more internally. I just feel that my parents, I think they did install a good base in me. Like when we lived in Bosnia, I would say like maybe when I was grade one, grade two, they were a little bit more involved. But then from that point on, it was more like they always encouraged me to be independent. So I always was a good student, even back home. And then when we came here, they really couldn't, I have a brother as well. They really couldn't focus on us as much because they needed to learn English. They needed to find jobs. So they unfortunately didn't really have much time to spend focusing on us. So we were just left to ourselves to make the best we could.
Yeah. Your parents were probably working really hard to get themselves and your family established here in the States. And
yeah. So actually my parents are still in Canada. They're in Canada.
Oh,
yeah.
In Canada. Excuse me. Sorry.
Yeah, yes. I know. I get that a lot, actually. It's funny. But it's really similar. The economic system in the United States and Canada, it's very similar. Like a lot of things are very similar. But so my parents, it was very tough for them. They ended up actually divorcing when I was in my 20s. They both worked very, very hard. My mom she actually ended up getting a government job. She worked at the forensic sciences unit. She did that whole CSI cool stuff, except she couldn't really talk about those cases, but all the cases that we would see on like Toronto news, like those are the cases she would get. And she retired recently. So she managed to buy herself a condo. She paid it off. And my dad, he opened up his own bookkeeping practice. So they've done well for themselves, considering that, you know, they didn't really speak English. But it was tough for them.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I am not the child of an immigrant family. So it's only by having wonderful conversations like this and reading that I continue to get glimpses into the challenges of what it means to be an immigrant family and to have to really start over. I mean, learning the language and the financial system of a new country is quite a challenge.
Yeah, the financial system for sure, because I mean, we didn't have, we come from a communist country, so there was no, you couldn't invest there. My parents only got their credit cards just like a few years ago. But I think the biggest challenge was the post-traumatic stress disorder for my dad. I think one thing that a lot of people don't talk about, or, you know, maybe the governments don't really see this, but this is really important. When bringing immigrants in from countries that were affected by the war, we really need to not only, we got tested, physically tested, and we're all healthy, but nobody tested us mentally. Like, were we mentally okay? What kind of traumas do immigrants go through? Because if you can fix the mental trauma, then it's so much easier for them to assimilate and start functioning better in the new country.
Wow. I really appreciate you naming that. So the assessments are not happening when we bring foreigners into the Canada or the United States to a more stable country. Maybe we do a physical assessment, but we're not doing a good psychological assessment. And yet there's psychological trauma.
Yeah, it's like little things. Like I'll just give an example. I don't like fireworks. I like seeing them. I don't like hearing them. It's gunfire. I remember when my kids were little, everybody wants to go see fireworks. I'm like, can I just put some earplugs? Because I just don't like hearing it. It just makes me feel very uneasy.
It brings back a lot of painful old memories for you.
Yeah. I think thankfully I didn't experience anything very traumatic. My parents did. But, you know, during the war in the city where I was in, there was shooting all the time. You hear it. And also, if you're wherever it is that you're living, in the nearby town, maybe there's a battle going on. And so you hear it. You hear the grenades. You hear stuff. So it's, you know, the sound. It's the sound that just kind of brings the memories back.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not just witnessing, it's hearing. It's just sometimes it's the tension in the air even that we can feel that. We have so many different sensory processes that we pick up information from. It's so astounding.
Welcome to 2024 and thank you for listening to the Healthy Love and Money Podcast. I'd like to take you behind the scenes of therapy-informed financial planning, where we talk about emotions, we talk about retirement plans, we talk about painful family experiences with money, and so much more. There's no need to hide things that leave you feeling embarrassed or ashamed about your financial situation. This year, we watch couples and individuals work through financial anxiety and start talking lovingly about money. We saw couples and individuals take action towards their goals, like closing a business that no longer fit them, paying off debt that felt crushing, increasing their comfort with their realized wealth, and ultimately overcoming some of those financial secrets that had been plaguing the relationship. Ultimately, the best part was seeing smiles return to our clients' faces about life, relationships, and money. This is why we do therapy-informed financial planning. I invite you to make 2024 the year you start therapy-informed financial planning. Check the show notes below to schedule your free 30-minute consultation.
When we were talking about before hitting record, yes, I'm really passionate about investing and teaching families how to invest. But what I'm really passionate about is well-being and wellness. And so I think that's what's so unique as I spend more and more time talking with people that are teaching money, is we inevitably come up against all the other areas of living and well-being. And we can be getting the money piece right and be struggling in other areas of life pretty significantly. So as you're growing and learning more, what does well-being mean to you at this point, and how do you help advance that in your own life and communicate it to others?
Well-being is, or just wellness, is probably my number one passion. A lot of times people think of me as the money lady, but and I'm still, I work at it really hard and I still struggle with it. It's not perfect. It's finding that right balance, the balance between being rested and being, working and pushing hard for your goals. And being a type A personality, it really doesn't help because I have big goals, I have big plans as to what I want to do with this company. So being an entrepreneur is definitely challenging. And to me, wellness is, just being at peace, being in the moment, being in the flow. But most of the days, I feel like I'm rushing from one thing to the next and I'm doing one thing, but I'm thinking about something else, what needs to be done. And the list to-do list is like 20, things on the list or whatever, even more. So it's really trying to figure out how to deal with some of that, embracing the unknown, I think, which is very, very hard. And I find that a little bit of spirituality helps there, regardless of, I know there are different religions and whatnot, but whatever your religion is, I think it just helps. For me, it's just, being spiritual in the sense of whatever's meant to happen will happen. Like, I've done my best and I just need to let it go. I can't stress over it. I can't have anxiety over it. It's not good for me. It's not good for my body. It's about trying to be kinder to myself, to make sure. I've always been very good in terms of eating clean and being active, like exercising. I just haven't been very good in terms of giving myself rest. I think that's really important, sleep and rest and just being kinder, like not pushing myself so hard when, my body's dying. And I feel like, I'm 44 and you hit a point where you realize, I can't go at the same rate I used to go before. And I literally had a crying session a few weeks ago to my husband because I said to him, like, I just realized I can't do this anymore. And I could do it. Like, I used to work when I was working for the accounting firm. I was 9 months pregnant. My son was about to be delivered and they were making bets in the office whether or not I was going to make it. But I worked from 6 a.m. till 2 a.m. and it was insane. I would go home and I would clean and I would cook and I had this abundant energy and I just don't have it anymore. So it's realizing that, you know what? Things have changed and it's okay. This is new season in my life and I need to accept it. And I have to be very careful what I take on. So I'm very protective of my time. I try to be. Yeah, there are a lot of lessons I'm still learning because, you know, I keep, you know, bumping into things that make me rethink the way I'm doing things.
I really appreciate your vulnerability and willingness to share that and to normalize. I think, you know, I'm 42 and in our 40s, I feel like I'm coming into my own new sense of what it means to be human and my own limits. And we're growing and changing. We're not steady as humans. And so what our needs are and what we're capable of doing ebbs and flows. And, you know, I think for many of us that grow up with some combination of trauma in our background, our survival instinct is to be successful and to work compulsively is one of those features of it. Right. And yet, like, because some part of our brain doesn't know that we're actually safe now.
That's exactly what was said to me. Somebody said to me, I was having a conversation with this lady who's a therapist, and she said to me, but she's like, you do realize you're safe now. You don't need to push as hard. And it's true. Like, I don't have to, but somehow I still do. And I have to realize when that's happening and stop it.
Well, and I think, you know, what I've come to appreciate more and more as I study the brain, which, I mean, I still pinch myself that I studied the brain like at all. Like, that just blows, you know, as a former firefighter, like, I don't know, sometimes I just kind of pinch myself that this is my life. But, you know, I was reading this morning actually about the brain, and they were talking about how our belief systems, what we cognitively say we know is true. Like, you say, yes, I know I'm safe. I live in Canada now with my husband and my kids. I'm safe. And yet, that's only one part of your brain that knows that. There's in your nervous system and in the brainstem and in the limbic system, still can feel the fear, even in anticipation of it, and amp you up into that driving mode. Hence the fireworks. Like, hey, for me, sometimes I you know, true confessions, I turned on, Chicago Fire the other night, just to kind of test myself and to see, like, what would my reaction be as I saw different firefighting sequences? Because, like, that's where so much of my trauma lives. And so, you know, as we're recovering from trauma, trying to figure out, like, oh, what are our triggers? What drives us into action? What takes us back into a sense of calm and ease? And yeah. And then, you know, we have this whole money piece where it's like, we have to get over our fear of money and our fear of investing. And then we grow our investments and our balances go and grow and grow. And then it's like, oh, that's a really big number. What's coming to mind as I say that?
I don't know. I mean, it's funny, actually. Like, I was just thinking about what you said when you first started talking. You know, you said that brain is, you know, knowing what you know is only one part, but I feel somewhere deep inside, there is more. And I think it's that deeper part that I, for example, for me, I need to get in touch with. And in order to achieve better wellness and to become, you know, more okay with resting, for example, and giving myself permission to sit on the couch, even though, like, my to-do list is like 2 pages long, somehow I have to tap into that. So whether that's therapy, whether that's meditation, whether that's, I think there are I don't know the names of these therapies, but it's almost like they help you figure out, like an event happened in your past and then you were just going over it, but it's, they help you see it differently, or I forget what that therapy is called.
Yeah, there's a number of them. There's this trauma-informed cognitive behavioral therapy. There's EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And so there's a number of good therapy models out there to help people work through the old memories. And the psychology or understanding is we have to kind of go back and reprocess those memories or those experiences to help our mind, brain, and body know that we're actually safe and the threat's over now. And that's why a lot of times I think we can't just tell ourselves, well, we should just rest. And then we just go to rest. Because there's signals inside of our bodies and memories inside of our bodies that say, it's not safe. It's not okay to rest, right? And until we can really connect with that, it's hard to get to rest.
Yeah, that makes sense. Absolutely.
So I'm curious, Maya, you're the money guru. You're teaching parents and families about investing and money. How does it go in your household when you talk to your husband about investing? And, you know, how do you guys work through differences in thinking about investing for the future versus living for today?
Yeah, it's really challenging, you know, because I, as you said, like I have this maybe trauma from the beginning where I did not feel safe. So I am a little bit more reluctant to spend money. And, but I think we actually, not that I think, I mean, I know that we agree on the fundamentals of like how we want to raise our family. When it comes to finances and what kind of values we want to instill in our children. And one of the values that we want to instill in our children is that, you know, it's okay to enjoy money as long as we enjoy it responsibly. Meaning that if, you know, the money comes in, let's say from a paycheck, we put aside money for retirement, we pay our bills, and we do certain things that we need to do with that money. But then the money that's left over, it really should be used for enjoyment. So my husband obviously comes from a different background. And so for him, it's a little bit easier to enjoy that money. I still feel guilty every time we go on vacation or, you know, spend that money. And so I am working through that. But it's good to have a partner who's not, you know, who hasn't gone through the same stuff like you. Because, you know, we help each other. We kind of correct each other. In terms of like, you know, if you're spending too much, I'm kind of like, okay, slow down, you know, or if I'm, you know, reluctant, I actually was reluctant a few months ago to buy this one dress because I had a speaking engagement at this conference. I was one of the keynote speakers. And then he was like, you're kidding me. Like this dress is something that we could definitely afford. Just go for it. But then I'm like, oh, but I have so many other dresses in my closet. Right. So it's really good to talk it out and to like really just realize, okay, like, am I being silly now? Like, I really don't need this behavior. It's the money mindset that I grew up with and I need to leave that. I want to, you know, I want to embrace more of a abundance mindset rather than this scarcity mindset. So we discuss everything. We are on the same page. You know, every once in a while, I will notice, even sometimes, you know, you could be saying you're on the same page, but then maybe things are happening and you're not achieving. Let's say we have a goal and this happened in the past. You know, we agreed we're going to go for this goal. We're going to achieve it. And then a year goes by and we're nowhere, not even close. And then we talk about it. It's like, yeah, we're on the same page. This is what we want. And then another year goes by and it's like, okay, this didn't happen. So then at that point in time, it's for me, it's like, okay, like what is going on here? Let's discuss it because we're saying we're okay with it, but something deeper is, you know, happening on the inside that maybe we're not discussing. And then usually when we have conversations like those, that's when we realize that we're not on the same page. But when we are on the same page, we achieve so much together.
Oh, music to my ears. And it's hard work to get on the same page. And then it's not just getting on the same page, but staying on the page, and things can drift because our life is, you know, I like to say our life is dynamic and evolving. So we have new requests and new expectations that are coming up all the time. And So it's very easy to say, yeah, our goal is to have this money for this nicer vacation. And then the kids' soccer program shows up. And, oh, and there's also this extra training you can do with the soccer program. Oh, and by the way, my mom needs some medical help and support. And you're doing those things because those are important to you too. But then you lose track of like, oh, wait, but we want to go on this nice vacation. And so there's this kind of continuous feedback loop as a couple about being connected about where are we going and where are our different priorities. And
yeah,
it takes a lot of work.
And I think things change for sure. Now, as I said, I'm 44. We have 16 and a 14-year-old, and you know they will be leaving soon to go off to college. And so all of a sudden I'm thinking, I don't know if I want to be in Canada all year round. This is something that we're currently discussing. I mean, it's cold. It's cold more than it's not. And I just, you know, we were talking about it. And I said, what about, I have no idea what's going to happen. But we're just currently discussing maybe a real estate property in Florida, maybe in Costa Rica. Like, I don't know. But you're right. It does change. Like, I did not think about this before. But now that I'm getting older and kids need that, they need us a little bit less. You know, I'm considering these things.
Well, that's, I think, you know, so you have those new considerations. I imagine your husband has new considerations too as life is going on. And that's where I think, I don't know, what do I say? It's like, we have to learn as a couple to continue to have these conversations and get updated with, what are you thinking about for your future? What am I thinking about for my future? And then how do we find, continue to develop or sow common ground together? Because it's so easy to grow further and further apart as the kids get older and older.
Exactly.
And so if you had to like say, here's one lesson that I've learned that's really helped me have better conversations with my husband around money, what do you think that is?
I just think it's important to find that quiet time and just talk about it. But it's also important for one person at least to be the more organized one to say, okay, this is our plan. This is how we're going to do it. And this is what I'm implementing. Are you on board? And then let's follow this because, you know, my husband and I, we would love to talk, but somebody has to implement it. So that usually someone is me. And, he is really good. He jumps on board and you know, we're able to accomplish whatever it is. So, but as I said, there were a couple of times before where, you know, we talk and then, you know, it's like nothing's happening. So usually when it's like that, then I know something's up. But, having those conversations, like we like to go for walks quite often, just the two of us and, you know, just talk about our day and whatever. And then, if it's really cold outside, I started complaining how it's cold and I really want to live somewhere else. So again, it's like having that plan and how are we going to execute that plan? And somebody has to be the one to hold the couple accountable. I mean, both of them should be held accountable, but one person needs to kind of drive it forward, I think.
Yeah, usually there is one person that's doing a little bit more of the initiating or the follow through. And I would imagine, you know, if we talked about the wider circle of your marriage, there may be other places where your husband picks up the steam and carries the family forward and in other areas. And so, you know, you do a lot of the financial planning and projecting and he maybe, you know, will do something else. And it's this give and take, but it's, you know, for a lot of couples that I talk to, especially where one person's a money professional, it adds this extra layer of complexity because the non-money professional partner kind of feels like they don't have a voice or they get overrode and their thoughts and considerations are not as valued as the person that's the money pro.
Yeah, no, we are pretty much equal, I would say. But I do drive a lot of changes or goals that we have. And I feel like I'm the one that will implement the system. So he's really good at following through, which is amazing. So when we decided to pay off our mortgage, the very first home that we had, I remember, like this is like 20 years ago, but I had this notebook. And in that notebook, I would write things like things that are coming up that are big expenses. And we would just make sure that in addition to our emergency fund, like we were putting things towards those big expenses. So we were one of the first couples to get married out of our friends group. So we had a lot of weddings coming up, you know, baby showers, whatnot. Like it was expensive, right? So we would put money aside for that. And then below it, I remember it was like, I had like our mortgage balance and whatever our regular monthly payments were. And so one thing in Canada that we can do, and I'm not sure if it's the same in the US, but we can actually change our payments to be weekly as opposed to monthly, because that helps with
the
paying off the mortgage faster. Yes. So we did that. And then they said that, oh, you can also like increase your payment to be a little bit more. So we did that to whatever we thought we were comfortable with. And then literally at the end of every month, whatever money was left over, we would just put it onto the mortgage. But he was the one that I kind of implemented that notebook. And every week, like he was the one filling it out. And I don't know, there was just something therapeutic, I think, for him. So he just jumped on board. He was doing it. He was kind of driving it. And, you know, it's like you give him a mission, he's on it. So it was really helpful.
Give him a mission and he's on it. I love that. Well, Maya, as we bring this conversation to close, I think the other big lesson is like, what have you learned about communicating investing to kids? What's something that listeners can really take away? If they're at home, they've had kids, they've never had a conversation about investing, how do parents start that conversation?
Yeah, so it's important to talk to them in their own language. So if you have a 10-year-old, you want to pretend that you are 10 years old. And so whatever it is that you're saying, try to explain it like a 10-year-old would. And don't add too much, you know, complexity to what you're saying. You know, just explain it very simply. If your child asks more questions, then you can, you know, give more explanations. But, you know, if they're, whatever you say to them, if that satisfies them, you know, their curiosity about investing, then just leave it be. The thing is that most likely you will be explaining this stuff over and over again until eventually it sinks in. It doesn't sink in right away. But when it comes to investing, I really like to tell kids that they're not only consumers, they can be owners. So, and I know this particular company that I'm going to mention, they haven't done really well, but this was a very, very good lesson for my kids. They used to play Roblox a lot, especially during COVID. And when Roblox was going public, that was a perfect time for us to like teach our kids about investing. So we did buy some Roblox shares and, you know, they're not doing that well, but that's okay. To me, you know, the way I was looking at it, I think we bought them at like $40. I think it was like $40 a share. I mean, I've spent like very honestly, yes, I'm this money expert, but I've spent $40 something really stupid, you know, like
sure.
A stupid way.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, of course.
You know, this was like $40 in my opinion that, you know, Roblox is not doing all that great, but it was a great learning lesson. So, you know, we were so excited about this IPO and we were explaining to them, like, why is Roblox, you know, going public? Oh, well, they need this money from the rest of us who believe in Roblox and they're going to invest this money and try to build even a better company. And then we would watch the news or I would like, if we're having dinner or like I'm driving them somewhere, I would be like, oh, Roblox was in the news and this is what they said. Do you think the price is going to go up or it's going to go down? So, you know, it was just involving them to understand that they have actually invested money into a business. It's not just like a company. Like a lot of times when people invest, they're like, oh, I invested in, let's say, NVIDIA. But to this day, I haven't invested in NVIDIA, even though it's so popular in the market, but because I don't know what NVIDIA does exactly. Like, I don't understand it. Maybe NVIDIA is part of like some of my ETFs and index funds that I invest in, and I'm okay investing that way. But I haven't bought actually NVIDIA stocks because I don't know what NVIDIA does. So I never invest in anything that I don't understand. So with my kids, the whole lesson about Roblox was, you know, we're investing in something you guys understand. And it made them feel proud that they were part owners of Roblox.
I love that. The pride of ownership and just showing them and teaching them about the ownership side of life and what that means. And, you know, I'm in the heat of raising kids. I've got a kindergartner and a first grader. And so they're both, you know, busy trying to learn how to read. And they're just learning to recognize letters. And so when you said, you know, there's going to be a lot of repetition and it's going to get a little bit more complicated as they go. And I think, you know, if you've taught your kids or you've seen your kids learn how to read, investing is a lot of the same way, right? You got to learn the letters first, and then you got to learn the words, and then you can put together sentences, and then you can put paragraphs, and then you can get really conversational. And so there is a knowable path and just taking your time. So just knowing where you're at, do I feel comfortable with the letters? Do I feel comfortable with the words? Can I put sentences together? Can I put paragraphs? It's okay. Just give yourself the time and have wonderful conversations. So if people want to connect with the work that you're doing, how do they find you? Where can they find your wonderful book?
Yeah, sure. So thank you so much for mentioning that. I'm on Instagram a lot. My handle is teach.kids.money. I do have a blue check mark next to my name. So just make sure you don't follow any of the scammers because they pretend to be me and they might be emailing you or messaging you to sell you crypto and God knows what else. But so the book is available on Amazon and any bookstore. It's called From Piggy Banks to Stocks, The Ultimate Guide for a Young Investor. And also, if you want to learn the basics of investing, check out my wealthykids.club. That's the website. So it's not .com, it's .club, wealthykids.club. And by the way, I also have some free resources about ETFs and index funds on my Instagram. So if you actually go to my main page under the bio, there is a resource that you can click on and download. And it just explains ETFs and index funds in more detail. So that hopefully, you know, you can get more interested in investing in those because I absolutely love them.
That makes two of us. Well, Maya, thank you so much for the work you're doing to help improve the many lives of the families you touch. And I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
I invite you now to stop for 5 or 10 minutes and reflect on what you just heard. Maybe even journal about it. Give yourself the time to consider what you just heard and what it means to you. By giving yourself the time to reflect and integrate what you just heard, it will help you along your journey of learning, healing, and growing towards financial intimacy in your life. Please like and follow this podcast and share with someone that would benefit from being on the journey of financial intimacy. Wishing you healthy love and money, Ed.